Hello and welcome back to the Nowhere Office, wherever you are, with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
This is the podcast which looks at the world of work as it is, as it could be, should be, might be, with some of the leading thinkers and doers of the day. So welcome to this episode of the Nowhere Office, and I'm really happy to be joined by one of the legends in the workspace, and I'll tell you why he's so legendary. He is Roy Bahat. He's the head of Bloomberg Beta, the venture capital arm of Bloomberg, which invests in particular in work and work related new startups. I'm going to ask him to verify that, but I've got to carry on telling you how wonderful he is before I do that. Roy was one of the original members of the American Future of Work Commission. I recently attended at his invitation a fascinating conference in Baltimore called Going to Work, which was supposed to be mainly secret, but I hope in the course of the next half hour, we will be able to divulge at least some of what happened there. And before I actually let Roy speak, I'm also going to say that he's a very, very distinguished academic. Let's start with the British bit, a Rhodes Scholar, a Harvard Magna Cum Laude, which for anyone who doesn't know about academia is, you know, very, very high ranking qualification. And he now teaches himself business at Barclays Haas University in California. So a thinker, a doer, an investor in work. Roy, have I got that even vaguely right?
I mean, only with the caveat that now I can't help but disappoint. The facts sound right. And, you know, as you know, with, you know, degrees, it's a blessing to have them. And also, you know, if I walk into the cafe, you and I pay, me and anybody else pay the same price for the cup of coffee. So I'll just say this, which is of all the different hats that I wear, student is still my most comfortable hat. And so I often feel with the issues that you talk and think about, we're all mostly in learning mode because who knows what's going on.
What about student and teacher? I mean, do you like teaching?
I love teaching. I love teaching. But the reason I teach is I teach for two reasons. The first is it makes me uncomfortable. You know, in a professional life where, you know, I'm 47 and most days I feel like I'm doing things I feel extremely comfortable doing. The first day of class every year, and I teach a course in alternating years at Berkeley's Business School, like you said, one course on the media, and the other course is a first of its kind course in the country on how to lead an organized, unionized, or otherwise workforce.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk to you about that.
Yeah, I mean, both of those, I get scared when I stand in front of the class. And the second reason is to learn. The extra bonus on top, which wasn't the reason to do it, is that I get to track some of the students as they evolve throughout their lives. And as a VC, I've gotten to invest in some of their businesses and dot, dot, dot. But I mostly do it because it's scary.
But on the unionized workforce point, you know, I'm deeply interested in the positive role of unions in the workforce. And I've been aware for some time that it's going to play a critical role going forward, that there's been something of a resurgence or a renaissance or a renewed vigor in discussing unions. And the union position was pretty evident at your conference. But most corporates, and you are a deep corporate, Roy, you're an investor.
I am a deep corporate.
Most corporates body swerve unions. So what's going on there? Yeah. Just start with that.
Well, it started for me, I've been working on trying to understand organized labor better as probably my number one priority, maybe twin priority with AI for the last 3 years. And I see AI, which we can talk about, as the single most important technological trend affecting work. And I see organized labor as the single most important human trend affecting work. And it started with a pretty simple set of realizations, which is I just thought there would be a lot more of it no matter what anybody might say. And the reason I thought that is, and you know, the UK has its own parallel path here, but in the US, working class people who have been in a horrible spot for a very long time tried in 2016 voting for a political extremist, thinking it would help them. You know, he promised them jobs. He promised them all kinds of things in his acceptance speech where he, you know, where he responded to his victory in 2016. He said, you know, we're going to build a lot of infrastructure, which ironically is what Biden then did. But they tried voting for an extremist. It didn't work. You know, they tried playing the game by the rules, studying hard, going to school. It didn't work. And so eventually this highly imperfect tool of a labor organization, because all democracies are highly imperfect, was, I thought, their only remaining tactic that they would try. So that was one realization. The other is in tech. I saw the large number of changes tech companies made because of the pressure of their own employees or workers organizing. Google stopped selling a certain kind of AI to the Department of Defense, and Amazon, you know,
in Israel, wasn't it? Or was that separate?
No, to the American Department of Defense. And, you know, and that was just a few hundred employees getting together and signing a letter. And so I just thought, wow, that looks like Amazon had a thing with climate change and Jeff Bezos committing money to climate change, the two women there organized. So I thought, this looks like power. People have no other choice. And so I just thought, there's going to be more of it. I've got to understand it and try to help it unfold in a constructive way.
Well, we're definitely going to come on to AI and work. I just want to keep on the union thing because it's so interesting. I suppose the caveat is that you're very much in the Democratic Party, you know, as an activist and so on. And what you're describing is you're seeming to say that Donald Trump's election the first time, because I suspect he's going to be reelected, you seem to be saying that the broken promises count for a rise in unionization across the workforce. And well, that to me is in a way more interesting than the party political point of who might be more responsible, because it's a global trend, as you say, in the UK for sure, in France in particular, the Gilets Jaunes. So that we're witnessing, aren't we, what the Kennedy Harvard School professor Barbara Kellerman calls follower power, aren't we? We witnessed a couple of weeks ago with OpenAI when I think it was 700
that was an organized labor victory too.
700 out of 770 employees basically said to the board, reverse your decision, and they did.
That's
so
right.
Leaving aside the politics of who might be driving it, you're talking about a corporate world that is no longer satisfactory or safe or pleasing to workers, aren't you? Or
yes.
A public sector world.
And I mean, I'll say as a business leader, and I want to come back to the politics for a second because I do think it's all connected. But as a business leader, I think that it's first the responsibility of businesses to make sure that people who work for them are okay. I think that is, you know, in our society, in all the stakeholders that a company serves, their workforce is arguably the one that ought to be most important to them because it's the one over which they have the most direct ability to help. And when I see that companies like Walmart have a significant proportion of their workforce on public assistance, I just kind of scratch my head and think, wait a minute, something here must be off. And I also believe, and the American history bears this out, that it's possible to have a rapidly growing, vigorously competitive economy and one that is great for workers at the same time. And I think that for that to happen, the tradecraft of how to balance and integrate different forces of power, the force of a strong entrepreneur and the force of a workforce, have to be woven together. And so that's kind of, and you know, we wrote in Harvard Business Review a magazine article on how to lead an organized workforce, where we made the case it can make you better as a CEO. It doesn't always. There are plenty of unions that can be obstructionist, and there's work to do there, but it can. And that was their first piece about organized labor in their magazine in 32 years, just to give you a sense of how out of habit we are as business leaders with the skill of knowing how to do this. It's kind of unimaginable because we're so out of habit. I mean, it's sort of like, why don't you go to the library to get a book?
Yeah. Did you take inspiration or reference in that piece to Germany? Because, of course, the kind of worker boards idea is about a kind of integrated sense, isn't it? That workers have a voice.
We did. The only thing about Germany that I think is quite different is that there are so many different differences in the society. and so many differences in the structure that picking any one piece is hard. And to be honest, I think the American economy has been more successful than the German economy. Maybe not by the measure of taking care of its least well off, but if you look at innovation, progress, growth, which ultimately I think is the engine that allows you to pay for all the other things you do, I don't think it can come the price of progress. I think it has to be, we don't get to choose between justice and progress. Justice has to, we have to find ways that justice accelerates progress.
So the working assumption that trade unionism was on the wane is in fact wrong, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think we know yet. I think it's still very much TBD. And I don't want to put it merely on Trump or politics. And I'll just say, I'm registered without party affiliation. I've done a lot more work on pushing, getting out the vote generally, which is another reason I'm interested in worker organizing, is it makes people more democratic, as small right. D democratic as
citizens. Forgive me if I overcast you as a Democrat.
No. I just want to, I think it's fair. Yeah, I mean, I think Trump is a horrible, horrible calamity. So in that sense, it's fair. But, you know, my current boss was a Republican. My prior boss was Rupert Murdoch. And so, you know, I'm very happy to understand that one can find allies across the political spectrum. And it's not like Hillary Clinton, you know, had the right policies on this either, or that Barack Obama saved the working class. And so it's a shared responsibility of the society as opposed to laying it at the feet of any one leader.
Fair point. And for anyone listening to this rather than looking at this, and I suspect more people will be listening, they won't see me doing this, which means, I mean, Roy could just talk forever and he's so fluent and fluid. I never want to interrupt him, but as he has a
Please
hard
do.
Stop, when I raise my pen, Roy, it means I need to ask the next question. And actually, what this leads me to is there are a couple of areas that I particularly wanted your take on in regard to the future of work, including AI. And one of them is culture, which I now think is political. We're in the middle of a crisis of a war in which workplaces are particularly riven, shall we say, unlike the Ukraine war, where I think it's fair to say the majority of people in workplaces did not feel riven over who was right. The situation in the Middle East at the moment is absolutely the polar opposite of that and polarized. So politics is very much coming into the workplace, isn't it? Whether it's about unionization, whether it's about sexual identity or abortion or about war. How new is that in your experience of workplaces? You've got a very distinguished 30-year career in which politics and the culture of work were not seen to be connected, right?
Yeah, it's a beautiful question. And actually, I wish I had data on it. I wonder if somebody surveyed it. So I'll give you my anecdotal sense. My anecdotal sense is it's a lot more prevalent. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One reason is, it's the fault of companies who said to people, you know, we want you to get your dry cleaning done here. We want you to have your meals here. And then we want you to believe in what we're doing as a company and treat it as more than just a job. It's an identity, and bring your whole self to work. And it's like, okay, you do all that and you can't ask the person to check their social beliefs and their political beliefs at the door. And then you have companies say, you know, if you want a worker to be hardcore, then they're going to bring themselves, their entire self. So I think that's one factor. I think the other factor is the blurring of just our life experience between work and life because of our digital devices coming home with us and the tools we use to get news accessible to us on our workplace computers. The lines have blurred. And so it's not like when you commuted in, read your morning paper on the commute, set aside the political section, walked into the office, and then never thought about it till the end of the day. And so those two things, the blurring of work and life in just the day parting of a typical day, and the invitation of companies, particularly in the information industry, I'm not saying this is true if you're a barista at Starbucks, actually maybe is to some degree, because they want you to believe in the company. Those two factors, I think, made it much more prevalent to have work-related considerations that are social and political.
I mean, it's ironic, isn't it, Roy? Because just at the moment when AI is transforming workplaces, including around issues like well-being, you know, Arianna Huffington explained to me how, you know, the precision tracking of an individual worker's habits leads to a better alignment of the technology that supports them in well-being, for example, the personalization, the ultra-personalization. It's ironic that the humans are so riven and getting more complex in their emotional makeup at work. You're right. There was a terrible and possibly helpful simplicity about the way work was organized culturally for a very long time, which is, you know, you had your bowler hat or you had your uniform.
That's it.
Or you had your, you know, you had your kind of don't mention the war issues. And now that's those boundaries of dissolved. What do you feel, though, technologically is happening in the companies that you're being asked to invest in around the next phase of the workplace? Do you, for example, foresee, I'm making this up, maybe it's mad, do you foresee some fabulous unicorn is going to come to you and say, Bloomberg Beta should invest in conflict resolution software at work?
I mean, it's possible. I think that I'll share some of the areas. So we were, over my objection at the time, I was wrong. The first venture capital firm to say that we wanted to focus on investing in AI. We did it in 2014. We invested in a generative AI company in 2016. You know, and so we've been at this for a while and seen the trend. And what we believed then and still believe now, and it's still only just beginning to happen, is to me the right way to think about it is less which area will AI affect and more how will AI affect every area, because it will be just as pervasive. What we currently call software will look and feel like what we believe right now only lives within the window of ChatGPT. And
I totally
AI will be predicting many, many things about our work, generating plenty of the content. And we are going to have to renegotiate our relationship to each other in the workplace, because it's going to, you know, reshape the organization chart, the communication path. And so, yes, conflict resolution, but I just don't know whether that will be the label of a category of software. Depends more on the psychology of an IT buyer than it does on what the software will do.
Right. I mean, I had a fantastically interesting conversation at your conference, Going to Work, which resulted in an interview, which will make it into my next book, Working Assumptions, with Diana Tsai of Upwage, mm-hmm. a company that you invested in, which I've been talking up all over the place with people like Azim Azar recently in one of our pods, because for me, Upwage is a very positive take on how to use AI, both to create new markets in talent acquisition, as she's doing, but also around equity and fairness in hourly wage workers being able to far more easily access information about who's paying what rate. Is fairness a driving force? Is social purpose a driving force in some of the companies you invest in?
Of course. I mean, I think that there are very few founders who create a business without having some desire to see the world improved by what they do. And so to the extent that one of the sources of inequality has been access to resources that allow you to earn more resources, access to research, access to skills, then AI can be a democratizing force. I don't think it's inevitable. I think it will require some government policy in addition, but software like Upwage's software, which allows hourly workers to find and apply for jobs that pay them more to be upwaged, feels like one attempt at it. And, you know, I'm not one of these naive tech people who thinks that the way to make the world better is just to let all the tech startups do what they need to do. It all has to work in concert, but absolutely. Now, at the same time, AI may end up concentrating wealth in the hands of a very small number of people who are the ones who own the models. And so these two forces have always been at play. Same thing with the internet. And with the internet, while it certainly helped everybody, it also certainly drove inequality.
Yeah, absolutely. Roy, let's just unpick for our listeners and, you know, what does AI at work now and in the near future mean? I think it means for some of the knowledge workers, you know, obviously being able to search and prompt, you know, people mm-hmm. talk about a prompt library, but just unpack, you know, 2, 3, 4 key things that AI at work is going to affect: white collar work or blue collar work or both?
Yeah, let's start with white collar work because it's the work that you and I both practice and know. And yes. I just say a shorthand for it. And my former teammate, Siobhan Zillis, who was on the board of OpenAI, was the one who put this idea in my head. She was responsible for our push into AI, which now my partner, James Cham, who did that with her, drives. Is it sort of like making everybody as skilled as the most skilled person, or giving them the tools of the CEO? You know, if the CEO had a personal speech writer to help them draft their speech based on a sentence or two, well, we now have an okay, if not great, personal speech writer. And so it just gives everybody access to a base set of tools outside of white collar work. I think, first of all, I think that's also true to the extent those tools are useful in an occupation like truck driver. But I also think that what happens is the software will take on certain parts of the job. And so figuring out what are the areas where you as an individual need to work is really important. And training yourself on the use of those skills. And I've got a whole framework for talking about it if you want to go into it. But I think that it becomes, in the same way that when computers started to get introduced, there was a skill around, people said on their resume, proficient in dot, dot, dot. I think proficient in AI is a skill.
I agree completely. Do you know, I found the most wonderful 1936 essay by E.B. White in The New Yorker, in which he describes the sort of end of the Ford T, which for, you know, the 10, 15 years prior had been the dominant, you know, life-saving American car. And the way he writes in that essay is really about the foibles of how to use the car, you had to get to know it. There's some wonderful descriptions of the quirks, the oddness, how you hold the gear stick. I'll send it to you, Roy. I mean, it's fantastic. And it occurs to me that it's precisely what you've just said, that in the end, all new technology becomes old, and then another technology comes in that's new and it needs to be learned. And there are people that are learn it fast. To my absolute astonishment, I was able to correctly instruct DALL-E, the ChatGPT illustrating tool, to create some images for me that I'm experimenting matching with a human illustrator, more of which anon. So, but on other things, I'm clueless. Do you think, therefore, that in the end, as long as we signpost the skills correctly and provide signposting of those skills, we're not going to have difficulty teaching AI?
No, that's my feeling. Will.
You think we will have difficulty?
I think there will be difficulty because all these new things, I don't see any reason it would be different than any other introduction of technology, which is to say some people will embrace, some people will ignore, and there will be a continued kind of sifting. And I think that to some extent that's appropriate because that's what in a capitalist economy, what competition looks like. And that's completely fine. That said, I think that the way in which we support people to learn those skills in educational systems, and there are now some efforts to introduce AI into the educational system, not to use AI for education, that too, but to educate people about the use of AI. And we've done a terrible job of educating people about the use of computers. I mean, there, you know, in the US, we have one school that I know that I think has a model curriculum for this, which is a high school for entrepreneurship in Fresno, California, called the Patino School. Save that. I think that we've got precious few examples.
It's odd, isn't it, given that, you know, Dave Eisenberg of Zig Capital was talking to me about the fact that China has the equivalent of several football fields worth of businesses that are effectively technical colleges training very specific skills relative to the United States, which, you know, is the dominant economy. There are many reasons to suggest it will continue in some ways to be the dominant economy. And yet it appears to be still creating less technical skills and more Ivy League university skills. And that may become a pinch point, right?
100%. 100%. And there's a way in which this gets back to organized labor, which is to say that in a way, the biggest organized labor pool of all is the society as a whole, represented by the government. And training is a thing that often governments have done, but it doesn't have to be governments. Individual companies sometimes struggle. In fact, they don't fully invest in training because from a perspective of kind of social welfare, because they don't want to train somebody and have them leave to go work for a competitor. But if you look at what organized labor has done in other industries, there may be a model. For example, in Las Vegas, the Carpenters Union in the United States and Canada has built a 2 million square foot training facility where carpenters show up to get trained on the latest and greatest, everything from robotics to underwater welding to the emotional skills required for work. No individual construction project would be able to train its carpenters to do that. You have to aggregate the resources of the whole in order to do it. And I would love to see something like that for AI. I'd love to see a training center, you know, in the WGA, the Writers Guild of America deal in Hollywood. I'd have loved to see resources for training writers on how to get better at these things. And so I think that that's one way in which, if we're organized as a society, we can invest in the skills we need to accelerate progress.
You talk about work needing a superpower. Much emphasis up till now has been placed on, you know, empathy and emotional intelligence.
I think there's a bedtime story people like to tell each other. And the bedtime story is, if only, you know, we had the skills we pride ourselves on being human for, creativity, empathy, et cetera, then we'll stay ahead of the machines. The reality is the machines are actually really good at empathy. I don't know if you've tried using ChatGPT as a therapist. It's way better than most of my friends are. And
is it? Have you?
Yes, absolutely. It totally is. And if you go and you watch a movie like Her, and you're like, of course you could fall in love with Scarlett Johansson's voice. And, you know, there's a great book by a now deceased, unfortunately, Stanford professor, The Man Who Lied to His Laptop, all about how we anthropomorphize the machines. So I don't think those skills are the ones that are going to be valuable, but I do think there are some, we just don't know what they are yet. It might be control of the machines is more valuable.
You're a VC guy. You must have some working assumptions about the quality and the tipping of jobs. I attended the Founders Forum in New York recently, and you know that 20% figure of jobs being lost and being possibly replaced, but certainly being lost from white collar work was bandied about. What's your view at the moment as an AI investor and a very accomplished corporate watcher? What do you think about the jobs going forward?
Which aspect? Which ones we will have more of?
Yeah, or less of.
So first of all, I think it is the great puzzle for which I don't think we have a good answer yet, is what is the new job or the job for which we will need millions more people doing it, where you can feed a family that will be growing in the future? That's the big question. I don't have an answer. I've been looking for one for years. You know, we know jobs that will need a lot more of home health care aid, for example. But you can't really feed a family being a home health care aid, at least not in the US. And this gets back to government policy, where we already distort wages with government policy in lots of different ways. I mean, in the US, the tax code makes it much more advantageous for companies to use a dollar to buy a machine versus to employ a person. It's much cheaper because you can amortize a machine, but you can't amortize a person. And so I don't.
What does that mean? Actually, unpick that a bit. But for those less,
yeah, what that means is that, of course, what that means is that it costs me more in accounting principles. It costs me more to employ a person because I have to recognize the entire expense in the year I pay that person than it does to buy a machine, where of course the cash going out the door may be the same, but on a profit and loss statement, I can recognize the cost of the machine spread over the life of the machine. So my business looks more profitable when I buy a machine because the idea is the machine lasts longer, but that's just an artifact of human chosen accounting policies. And so we already have our fingers on the scale. We do not have a quote unquote free market. We have a jerry-rigged system of government incentives in one place or another. And so where I think there's going to be danger is less entire occupations writ large, although I think that'll happen, and more micro occupations. Okay, you know, there are 100,000 people who perform this specific task, and bam, software is created that, I don't know, I'll pick bigger jobs for a second. A mortgage broker, we already picked the job of illustrator. You know, there will be these kind of pinpricks, and it's less the large scale job. Lawyers, all lawyers are not going to go out of business anytime soon. And more that there will be this kind of keyboard being struck of this one gets hit here and this one gets hit there. And I think in a way that's worse because it will produce a much less predictable, much more rapidly acting effect. And that's the thing that creates hysteria. When everybody thinks, well, maybe it'll be my job next year, that's the thing that creates a kind of social hysteria. And that's why I think we're entering a really scary phase.
And partly that is because the narrative of governments, of businesses, of large scale organizations is to sort of sell certainty. And we're not in a certain period. We're not in a period, I think, where you can say there's a globalized norm for HR. I think we're into a new area where you say, well, the HR for this sector in this country, in this town, in this business at this time is what we need. So the micro niching, I think, there's a very interesting book by, I think it's James Harkin, might stand corrected, on niches that came out a few years ago that I always thought was very prescient. And on that note, Roy, of niches, are we in a weird way, and this is way my final question, are we in a weird way returning to the sort of artisanal approach to work?
Yes.
I
think that's right. I mean, if by that you mean that the more the occupation you practice tends to feel like something mass-produced and repeated at scale, the more vulnerable you are, absolutely. So that's one way in which I think we're returning to it. There's another way too, which is years ago, we worked with Anne-Marie Slaughter, who runs an NGO in the US and has been a huge advocate on many issues. She runs New America, on a study of the long-term effect of technology on work. And one of the parlor games that was popular in Silicon Valley at the time was, what will be the last job? First of all, I don't think there will be a last job in the sense that we'll just keep redefining whatever we do with our days as work. And which is, by the way, you know, if my great grandparents looked at what you and I are doing right now, they'd say they're not working. They're having like a, you know, a conversation I might have enjoyed having over tea with somebody, and they're just getting paid for it. And so we've already automated away a lot of work and replaced it with leisure that we've relabeled as work and figured out a way, you know, to get people paid for it. But I think that the last job will be one where, in the sense of the word artisanal, it's defined as having been made by a human being. And we have words like that. When something is handmade, we accord it a different value, not always a higher value, but sometimes a higher value. And a handwritten story versus an AI-generated story may be something we come to value differently just because it was made by one of us in our little human corner.
Well, that I can't end on a better note than that. The handmade, handcrafted human perspective. Roy Bahat, you've given me so much to think about. Thank you very much for being on the Nowhere Office.
Thank you for having me and for insisting that we have this kind of conversation that ranges widely. Your pen as an essential tool.
Isn't it interesting? The pen still remains mightier than the sword, or let's
hope
it does.
No question. Way more scared of you wielding that than a sword.
Well, I had the great pleasure of doing that interview with Roy, but alas, without Stefan, who, just to be confusing, was in America, as was Roy, but not in the same time zone. That's hybrid working for you. You've been listening to The Nowhere Office, normally presented by me, Julia Hobsbawm, with Stefan Stern. It's a fully connected production out of both London and Miami. Do follow us, like us, share us, and come back for more. Thank you for listening.